We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. For a basketball team that's won only one world championship, the Milwaukee Bucks have featured quite a few legends of the game on the court. Players like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Oscar Robertson, Moses Malone, and Ray Allen.
While the current generation of basketball fans might know these names, they are much more familiar with the dazzling work of current stars like Giannis Antetokounmpo and Chris Middleton. But a recent long-form ESPN documentary told the story of basketball in this country through an oral history from its players, and a recent book takes the conversation a step further. Rafe Bartholomew is co-author of the book Basketball, A Love Story, the companion to the film, and he joins us by phone to share more. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mitch.
So the thing, or one of the things that really hit me about so many of the stories these basketball people tell of, you know, how they fell for basketball is how many of them are solitary stories. You know, the player who would go out in their driveway or down to the playground or to the, you know, the basket that was nailed to a telephone pole and just play hour after hour after hour. Is there something in the experience of falling for this sport that makes it unique versus the other popular sports in the country, do you think?
I think so. That, and that solitary nature you're bringing up has to do with it's a sport that you can play and practice alone. There, that you can't. It's very difficult to go play catch in a meaningful way as a baseball player on your own. I guess, you know, you could throw against the wall. When I played baseball growing up, I even built like a thing to throw strikes into when I was trying to pitch. So you could do it a little bit, but it's just not the same as basketball. You can't have the experience that people like Bill Bradley and Bernard King are talking about when they're out on the court at night or in the gym alone, working on every shot, perfecting every move. Steve Nash talking about the way just imagining his way through a workout kind of opened up his mind to the realm of possibility of the sport. So that's something that I think is unique to basketball.
What was the moment for you when you connected with it?
Oh, for me, it was very early. My father had played basketball in Ohio and played when he moved to New York, and I grew up in New York at the time when basketball was very hot, the Stephon Marbury mm-hmm. high school era, and I started playing at like age 8 or 9. It really became the sport I loved when I got picked to join a traveling team for our rec center, which was sort of like the elite group of 12-year-olds, and one of my teammates was Smush Parker, who went on to play with the Los Angeles Lakers for a couple of years, and feeling, and some of the players expressed this, when you suddenly feel like you're so good at something, and in my case, it wasn't true. I was just playing with people who were that good with them. But when you all of a sudden feel that you are that good at something, you just want to keep doing it. You want to keep getting better and better and better at it. And then it became part of my blood in a way that I don't feel comfortable if I don't kind of get shots up every couple of days at least.
So this project had to be a little tricky for you. You and Jackie McMullen came into the book part of it after the interviews had already been conducted, right?
Yes. I've worked on shorter oral history projects when I was working at the website Grantland, and it is a much different process when you are there from the beginning, and the original intent of the project is for it to be published as a book or as an article in words, because your interviews then can shape this narrative. You ask a few leading questions kind of to provide transitions when you know you'll need them on the page. And Jackie and I did not always have the luxury of those kind of moments, because these interviews were conducted with the original intent of being part of Basketball, A Love Story, the ESPN film. So we did have to sort of get creative and find the transitions where we could. And it also, I think, limited what we were going to cover, right? We could only work with the words on the page. We couldn't really, in some cases, because Jackie is such a respected and long time, I mean, she is a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame media wing, she was able to go back and conduct a little bit of follow-ups or add players who weren't in the film to the books. But for the most part, we had these transcripts, which were rich and plentiful to, you know, our wildest dreams. But still, you couldn't change what was there. And in some cases, when something was missing or there was something that I wished had been in there that wasn't, there's nothing I can do. I can't call Oscar Robertson and say, "Hey, Oscar, how do I was wondering if we could just add a little bit of this in there." That opportunity didn't exist. And I bring up Oscar Robertson because there's one moment I had read about that I had always wanted to ask him about and kind of hoped to find in his interview. He did 5 hours for the film, but unfortunately it did not come up. And that was this time during the Knicks' first championship season when they started the year. This would, I guess, 1969-70. They started the year on this, at the time, record-setting winning streak. It was 21 games, 23 yeah. games. And one of the later games in that streak was at Cincinnati against the Royals, where Oscar Robertson was the star, and Bob Cousy had just been hired as the coach. And there was a moment where near the end of the game where Cousy, who was not a player coach, but decided to dress and sub himself into the game to throw an inbounds pass at the very end of the game. And from what I had read about it, Oscar Robertson was not pleased with that. He was like, "Get out of here. This is you are retired, sir." So I've always wanted to hear Oscar Robertson explain that a little bit, but it did not come up in the interviews. But so yeah, we it feels strange to say that we were limited by thousands of pages of interviews in depth with many of the greatest players and coaches and figures in sports history, but still there were things that just weren't there and we couldn't get to them.
Right. It's like the drinking from the fire hose metaphor where right. you've got all this stuff, but it's only the water coming out of that one fire hose.
Exactly.
Well, and you mentioned that story of Oscar Robertson, and it reminds me, or I guess it reminds me of this question. You know, we're talking at a time when basketball is again at or near the top of the heap. Did you feel any special responsibility in turning this into a book to the stories of basketball from the days when the NBA Finals were on tape delay? I mean, the time before everybody had access to all the information they wanted at all times.
I think I feel a little bit of that mission, and part of it is practical. While there is a lot of really strong material from the 90s, 2000s, this decade, today's players are very well represented. You have Anthony Davis, Steph Curry, Kevin Durant are all part of the film and the book and many others. They still, one, because they're active players and kind of have to be a little bit more protective about what they say in their interviews, and two, because their time is a little more precious, so they don't sit for 5 hours for an interview. So we just had more to work with. So there's with the older players in those generations, so there's a little bit of that pragmatism side of how they come to be such a big part of the book and the film. But I think there also definitely is that sense that these are the stories that I didn't know as well. These are the stories that I didn't grow up with and hear a million times on sports TV and already read 16 books about. The stories from those older eras, from when finals were on tape delay, and sort of the travel stories of the old Celtics and teams when they had to play in Fort Wayne, Indiana, they'd get dropped off by, like, you know, they'd like hitch a ride on a train in the middle of the night and get dropped off and then find some college kids to pick them up hitchhiking into town. Those sort of stories are the ones that, to me, really make projects like this special, because it opens up a whole world that existed but we just didn't know all the details about. We still don't know all the details about, but adding to that knowledge, I think, is really important.
There is something to be said for having these guys talk about stuff that happened 40 and 50 and even 60 years ago, and being able to add the perspective that they, you know, like they're looking back on this, whereas, you know, you talk to LeBron James now or Steph Curry now or whatever, and the stuff has just happened. They don't have that, you know, way to evaluate it in the context of everything else that's happened.
Absolutely. And those stars have to be protective of their images, their brands, how telling the full story of things could then turn into a huge news event that disrupts their entire season. They have to be a little more cautious than someone who's retired and can really just lay it all out there.
I want to ask you about a couple of games that you cover in depth in this book that maybe, fans today in the Giannis or Steph Curry era might not necessarily be familiar with. There was this one game in 1968 between UCLA and the University of Houston, and it was a regular season game. This wasn't part of the tournament. Why was this game at the Astrodome such a big deal?
Well, it was like the clash of the Titans. It was Lou Alcindor, who before he changed his name to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, on the epic UCLA winning streak. They were deemed unbeatable, and in fact, they were unbeatable for many years, winning championship after championship with John Wooden. And this version of it with Kareem was perhaps maybe the best, but definitely, I would say, sort of the one that people believed was the most untouchable, probably because of Alcindor. And they were playing Elvin Hayes, finally another big man with a chance to sort of compete on that level. And then the fact that they put it in this enormous arena with, I don't have the actual attendance number at my fingertips.
It was like 57,000 or something.
So it was a record setting, a number of people jammed into one place for a basketball game, and they said it looked ridiculous that they moved. It was just a tiny court in the middle of a football field, and people looking at the ants running around at the bottom. But just the magnitude of the event was unprecedented in basketball history. And it turned out that Houston won. They beat UCLA, and the stuff in the book is great, going back and forth between Elvin Hayes and the players on UCLA, who say that Alcindor was injured. He had an eye injury. He couldn't. He just wasn't. It wasn't 100% of Kareem there that night. And Elvin Hayes saying, like, look, well, we still won that game, and you can never take that back. That was the biggest game, even though Houston went on to lose to UCLA in the Final Four that year and lose badly. Even though they lost that game, Elvin Hayes kind of treats that game in the regular season as the most important game of the year because of the magnitude of it and because of what it meant. Finally, someone had taken UCLA down.
Right. For a guy who had plenty of really star moments in his basketball career, you get the sense that he still looks back at that as this shining moment in his basketball history.
Right, he's sort of like, you can never take that away from me, Kareem. In the way that, and he said that him and Kareem after that were always icy to each other on the court, even in the NBA, even though they had no, as professionals, they didn't have. It became the Lakers and the Celtics, and Kareem versus McHale and Parrish. You didn't really see Elvin Hayes in that mix against them, but I guess there was still that college passion still burned in them.
Yeah. The other game that it's actually still a matter of contention was the gold medal game in the 72 Olympics. And this is a result that people who played in the game still dispute.
And it's been interesting. A lot of younger basketball media people who I follow have looked back on it, and there's a little bit of revisionism saying that maybe it wasn't quite the screw job that the U.S. players believe it was when, they lost. It was the first U.S. men's Olympic loss in basketball in 1972 to the Soviet Union, the gold medal game. They replayed the last 3 seconds of the game three times, basically, until the Soviet team won. And there's a lot of questions about, was there a mechanical glitch on the shot clock? When were the Soviet team allowed to take a timeout, and when was it granted, and why they kept getting chances to replay it. Obviously, Doug Collins and Mike Bantam and the players involved in the 72 game felt strongly enough they made the very conscious decision, right, never to accept those silver medals. They did not appear on the podium at the games, and despite certain overtures by Tom McMillan, the one of the players on the team who went on to have be a congressman in Maryland for a little while. He made overtures about, well, maybe we can accept dual golds with the Russians and then give something to charities and we'll make something positive out of it. But there are guys from that team like Kevin Joyce who are just they have it in their wills that no one in their family can ever accept that silver medal under any circumstance, and the entire team would never do it unless it were unanimous. And it remains probably the most controversial game in basketball history, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea here is that it is in basketball a love story, but you know, you think of that story from 72 and you know many others in this book, and it could easily be basketball a love hate story. Did you have to weigh the idea of documenting love for the game against like keeping from over romanticizing it, having people just look back with these rose colored lenses?
Well, I think you hit on it when you say the love hate and the same passion that inspires all the love that the people in the book express for the game and probably a lot of the people who end up reading the book and watching the film feel for it themselves, that love obviously comes from a same strength of emotion that can become extremely painful. And I think neither the book nor the film shies away from many of the ways that it was that, whether you're talking about the NBA's early racial quotas and the chapter in the book on some of the really awful discrimination that black players in the 50s and 60s faced just trying to play the game, whether you're talking about Oscar Robertson's story of winning the Indiana high school basketball state championship with his all-black team and them not being given the same parade that had been traditionally given to all the other teams that won the state championship in downtown Indianapolis. Instead, they were bussed out to a field outside of town and just left there because they wouldn't give a parade to an all-black team at the time. Whether it's John Thompson, the former Georgetown coach and Celtics player, who's talking about how in a really, I guess it's a difficult observation, but a very true one and something that rings true today. He says that one of the biggest, or to him, the biggest myth in America is the idea of equality. He says, no man who had a leg up on someone else wants that person to ever become equal to them. There's this human instinct to be above someone, and various ways that was expressed in basketball. And the stories of Connie Hawkins and Roger Brown being blacklisted in the gambling scandals of the 60s and how their careers were unfairly ruined. And maybe they got some of them back, in the ABA and the NBA eventually, but their primes were taken from them and they were never the same people. So there is all that pain and hate. And I think the way you can still look at it as basketball, the love story, is everyone in the book faced some sort of obstacle to achieve what they did in the game. Often really, really overwhelming odds, whether it be growing up in difficult situations in urban areas, in rural poverty, in whatever, and just playing the game against all the things holding them back. It was a lot of what brought them to the levels they achieved. So in these cases, it does end up being more positive than not, a net positive, because basketball was the thing that allowed people to overcome and that passion, even when there were moments, really, really terrible moments involved. And, the pain and the hatred side of that passion was there. The love kind of won out in the end.
Well, and it seems like even at the end of this process for you, after going through, all of these, hundreds of hours of interview transcripts, you still need your fix.
Absolutely. 100%. I think and you talked about these interview transcripts. I reread them. They are even if they're raw and all over the place, being able to look at what feels like a version of the Dead Sea Scrolls of basketball, all this accumulated wisdom from generations of men and women and young and old who played the game. It's powerful stuff to see those raw words on the page.
Well, Rafe Bartholomew, it's powerful stuff to read on the even the non-raw words. Really enjoyable stuff.
Great. Thank you. Thanks.
Rafe Bartholomew is one of the co-authors of the recent book Basketball, A Love Story. It is the companion to the ESPN documentary film. You'll find more at WUWM.com.